Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Leroy Reams and Penny Fuller about Lauren Bacall. We also talk about the Regroup Theater's production of A Texas Trilogy, Primary Stage's production of Poor Behavior, and Coming, a rock musical of biblical proportions at the Fringe, and Skin in the Game, also at the Fringe. That plus some other news. Please stay tuned.
I feel groggy and weary and tragic, punchy and bleary and fresh out of magic, but alive, but alive, but alive. I feel twitchy and bitchy and manic, calm and collected and choking with panic, but alive, but alive, but alive. I'm a thousand different people, every single one is real. I've a million different feelings, okay, but at least I feel. And I feel rotten, you're covered with roses, younger than springtime and older than Moses. Frisky as a lamb,
la, la, la.
Lazy as a clown,
la, la, la.
Crazy, but I am alive.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Monday, August 18th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good evening, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many other places on the internet. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
So this week, this past week, we had the passing of a Broadway great, Lauren Bacall. And we're going to be joined in a few minutes by some of her co-stars and dear friends. And we're going to talk about their show together, Applause. So why don't we jump right into that? With us this evening, we have two special guests. Joining us from their respective places in New York is Penny Fuller and Leroy Reams. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us on a Monday evening to share your remembrances of Lauren Bacall.
Well, thank you for asking me and us.
It's going to be a pleasure.
Yeah.
So was it pleasurable to deal with Lauren Bacall during Applause?
Was for me.
Yes, I think for both of us, absolutely. It's interesting that with the show, Penny and I were both replacements.
Right.
And show. I replaced first during rehearsal, and Penny replaced out of town. So when I came into the show, they were literally from a week going out of town, and they had fired the guy playing the part New Year's Eve, and I was brought in the next day, and I had a very short time to learn everything. And so the first day of rehearsal, I was rushed in, and Ron Field, the director choreographer, said, "Then you make your entrance here, and then you come over, and then you go over and you stand by the closet in the dressing room, and then you have your line at the end of the scene." So I said, "Okay." So I said, "Well, when I come in, can I carry like a fall and a brush so they'll know that I'm a hairdresser, and that'll establish who I am?" And he said, "Yes, yes, if you want to do that." And so I looked at Bacall, and I said, "And Miss Bacall, I'll fluff your hair. I promise I won't do anything drastic to it." And she looked at me with that look. And lowered her head and said, "My friends call me Betty."
Uh-huh.
And I said, "Betty." And she said, "That's better." And so I went over and I stood by the closet, and they proceeded a long time into the scene. So finally, because the time was running, I raised my hand and I said, "What is it, Leroy?" And I said, "When does this character get out of the closet?" But Carl let out a big laugh, and that was the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
That's really nice.
It was sealed at that moment, and it was nothing but a pleasure, and we became best buddies and became like the characters in the show, which was interesting. And then
Yes, they really were. I mean, I was there too, but those two were thick as thieves.
but then out of town, Penny has to tell her story when she came in out of town.
Which part? Well, I came in, they brought me in from Los Angeles to look at it and to see if I wanted to replace. I had originally auditioned for it, and it was down between me and my predecessor, and they took my predecessor. And so now they decided they'd made a mistake, and they brought me in from California. And I saw the show, and I understood by looking at it I knew what I could do to fix to not fix it, but to do my part. There was to sort of anchor it to be a real threat to the Margot Channing, you know, to be somebody who could, you know, be adorable and you think she isn't a threat. In fact, I had said, let everybody think that they were, don't remember the movie right, that I'm so convincingly sweet that they, that when the turn comes. And so I remember thinking before I met her the next day, I thought, let her know that if I'm good, it will only help her. And she was fantastic to me. What story did you want me to tell, Leroy? Which one?
I know the first day of rehearsal when Penny came in to rehearsal, and she had her script, and the company was very nervous because I had already replaced, and now another part was replaced, so everybody was on pins and needles. And Penny came in and had her script in her hand, and we began blocking the same way that they had done with me quickly. And so Penny came in, and she made her entrance with her script, and she looked at all of us as the characters, and she looked, and then she looked at Bacall, and something happened in her eyes, which I saw, and I thought, look out. She knows what she's doing. And so as the scene proceeded, and we got to the end of the first act eventually, there's a scene where Eve Harrington looks up at Margot Channing, and Margot Channing says, starts to welcome to the theater, and she dismisses Eve. And Diane, who had done it before, sort of just shrieked off into the shadows, and Penny stood there, and as Bacall dismissed her, she looked at Bacall and dismissed her as she walked off. And Betty tore in to welcome to the theater, and when she finished the number, she turned around and she opened her arms and she said, thank God I've got an actress to work with.
And that's a great story. I'd forgotten that. I mean, I forget that because I was so busy trying to do it.
And that was it, because Penny had it nailed. And the difference between the reviews we got in Baltimore and the reviews we got in Detroit was Penny's performance. It made the show a hit. I'm very serious about that. I'm not flattering Penny. I'm just being honest. That performance changed the show and made it a hit.
Well, it's very interesting because I saw it in Baltimore, and I saw Diane do it. And what you just described in terms of the welcome to the theater scene is exactly what I remember. Penny, it breaks my heart to say I didn't see you do it.
I can do it for you. Just get up a new production.
The sooner the better. Anyway,
but you know, the thing that was so wonderful is that Betty, she was such a pro herself. That she, I don't even know if she consciously knew it, but she intuitively knew she needed a tennis player, you know, as somebody of equal, you know, to bat the ball back and forth, so to speak. And that's what she got with Leroy, and that's, I think, what Leroy's saying she got with me. Right, Leroy?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And also, she was quite lovely to all of us in the show, and we became a family, as you sometimes do when you do a show. And there wasn't a lot to fix on the show while we were out of town. Basically, it was the performance of Eve Harrington that changed it. And so when we got back into New York, we were a hit. We got the Tony Award for the Best Musical. And so it was a very happy company. And friendships that were made then still exist. And unfortunately, our dear Bonnie Franklin has passed on. But, you know, it was a very loving company, and Betty was very supportive and the leader, and it was her. It's what she did that made the company what it was, and it was a lovely, lovely time.
We should probably mention, since we've mentioned the first names, Penny replaced Diane McAfee, who was she already married to Brandon Maggard?
They never married Brandon Maggard.
Oh, okay, but regardless, they had an
affair out of town and continued the affair and had two wonderful children, Maude Maggard and Fiona Apple, and that was the result of that union, and so, but they never married.
Okay, thanks for setting me straight. And then Leroy replaced Garrett Lewis, who I would say most people know from probably two things. The London cast recording of Hello, Dolly! With Mary Martin. He's Cornelius. A role which Leroy later did, and in the film of Star, he does the number and everything with Julianne.
And he became a very important set decorator in Hollywood.
Oh,
really?
Yes.
I never knew that.
Oh, yes, he became very, very well known, and I think he even got up to being nominated for something or other along the way. Yes, he was very successful as a set decorator.
Gee, I'm glad I'm listening to this podcast.
Let me also say, even though we want to pay tribute to Lauren Bacall, the fact remains that Leroy Reams' performance in Applause is one of the most significant performances in the history of the musical theater, because it was the first time I ever saw a homosexual played as a human being and not as a caricature or as a satire or just a laughing stock. And that's what made it so special. And I will never forget that performance. I could picture you everywhere you were on that stage during that entire time, because that was the achievement of that performance.
Absolutely. Hey, Ray.
When we were out of town, when the gay bar scene happened, no one had seen anything like that on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And when we entered the gay bar, of course, the thing that brought the character out was Margot Channing says, "Duane, how would you like to take two lonely ladies out on the town tonight?" And he said, "I can't. I've got a date." And she said, "Bring them along." And that was the outing.
Right.
And so when we got to the gay bar scene, I was supposed to have entered, and there was a guy there that I was supposed to kiss. And then, and this is all done in Panama, and then I introduce him to Margot Channing, and of course he sticks out his hand to her, which was supposed to have been a laugh. So when we went into the gay bar scene and we're dancing, and I see the guy and I walk up and I give him a little peck, and the audience went like this. It was like the most shocking thing they had ever seen, and of course the handshake didn't get a laugh. And the next day in rehearsal, Ron Field said, "Leroy," I said, "yeah, tell me, cut the kiss." So it's interesting now that that was so shocking back in that time that it was.
Well,
and one of our reviews called the show a lot of homo ho hum.
Wow.
Well, this is less than a year after Stonewall, right?
Sure.
Yeah, and then also many years later, I'm at a party and a gentleman comes up and introduces himself as Frank Rich. And of course, I didn't know what he looked like, but I certainly knew who he was. And so I said, "Well, so nice to meet you." And I said, "And now I can say in person, you know, thank you for some of the lovely things that you've said about me." He said, "Well, I've always liked you because when you did Applause out of town in Baltimore, I was an usher."
Mm.
And he said, "I've always remembered that performance and remembered you fondly as a result." So how small the world. Today's usher, tomorrow's New York Times critic. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, I was just listening to the latest edition of the CD of Applause has some cut numbers, one of which is called Smashing New York Times, which is a lovely song.
It is.
Whose number was that?
The producer's.
I don't know, because it wasn't in the show.
It was Bob Mandan's number.
It was the producer's.
During rehearsal.
I think it was the Addison DeWitt character, whose name I can't – Howard – What was his name?
Well, he was Howard the producer, somebody. Though. Right, yeah.
Yeah, it's rewritten as a producer, played by Robert Mandan. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One who slapped me every night.
Well, it wasn't in the initial show we did out of town, because when I came in, it had already been cut.
And does it have my favorite song that was ever done that was cut, the new edition, I mean, Len Carew singing It Was Always You? Was that on there?
That has been recorded, yes. That was in Baltimore. I remember hearing that. Yeah,
I love that song.
Right, yeah.
I just love that song. But they decided they needed something. It was the opening number, really, the first solo, and they needed something a little more, you know, spiffy. So I don't want to go, but planes come back. You know, it had more humor.
I'm going to ask a question here. The rumor has it, and if either of you witnessed this, that would be very interesting, that Ron Field said to Charles Strauss, "We need a ballad." You know, and Charles Strauss said, "I'm not so good at ballads. It's not what I do. The only good one I've ever written is Once Upon a Time." And Ron Field said, "Well, then why don't you just write it backwards?" And in fact, And in fact, you know, when you think of it, "I don't want to go," it's Once Upon a Time. You know, I mean, there is an analogy. So I don't know. Neither one of you can verify that, huh?
No. But when was Golden Boy? Was that after this?
Before.
6 years earlier.
Before? And he never wrote a good ballad? Gee, some of the most beautiful music I've ever heard he wrote in that.
Yeah.
You bet.
Music.
To bring it back to Bacall, were any of her numbers cut or significantly changed during?
Not really. They put in a new number out of town, Something Better.
Something
that
greater.
Put in out of town.
Oh, yes. There was another. What was that other one called?
Love
and I loved her doing that. This time it's got... This time it's got to be better for me this time around.
Right, that's right.
That was the song that was cut, and some, there's something greater. There's something greater, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The story goes that Louis Botto from Look Magazine came down to see the show and said, that Love Comes First number just isn't good enough. You need something greater.
Mm-hmm.
And they took him literally. And,
my God, good for you, because I never...
I'm so glad we're here finding out all these things with Julie.
It may not be true. I never say what I say is true. I only tell you what I hear.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
There's a profound difference between the two. But
Penny, you had mentioned Len Cario before we started to record. You also mentioned that Penny and Leroy and Len and Len's wife Heather, you all got together and had a little dinner to remember Lauren. So or
yeah,
Betty.
We did on Saturday night. We went to Joe Allen's, which is where, of course, it was in the show. But that's actually the last place I saw her was at Joe Allen's.
And she loved Joe Allen's. It was a very one of her favorite places, and she adored, of course, the owner, as we all do. And so it's a special place for all of us.
Do you remember, Leroy, the night that, what was it, that she hurt her knee?
Yes, she had, during the show, she had a knee problem. It was cartilage, and her knee had torn. And so she came off, and they had to wrap her up and everything, and of course, the understudy, Gretchen Weiler, was there in a flash, ready to go, and Bacall said, she'll go on over my dead body.
Right.
She never
but
went
I remember,
on.
But I remember that, first of all, she didn't come on when she was supposed to. And Leroy, you know, Mr. Entertainment, said, I think I'll go find Margo, and he started running off to leave me alone on stage. But then when she came back on, and I can't remember what happened, but I looked at her, and she was so fragile with from the knee and the pain and the fear or the scary thing that happened. And I had never seen that side of her. I mean, we all know that underneath all that bark was a frightened little girl to some degree, as there is behind all of us one way or another, I guess. But I remember watching her and thinking, oh, my God, she was so fragile at that moment. And I don't remember what we did, but we bucked her up somehow. Do you remember
we got
that?
But then the thing was, they took the number, the big dance number, out of the show for about 3 weeks. We didn't do the big disco number. We danced in the disco and danced right out of it.
Oh.
But she never missed a performance ever in the show.
Yeah. Mm.
And that was the tour and everything else. She never missed a performance.
Isn't that something? We don't get that today.
No.
And she used to take either Leroy every night home, but sometimes she'd take me home in a limousine, and we'd sit and say, what the hell are we doing? We're the toast at Broadway, and what are we doing going home in a limousine alone, you know, blah, 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 and laughing and so forth. And when I went to see her, you know, I was living in Los Angeles years later, and she did Sweet Bird of Youth out there. And I went to see her, and she took me home in the limo, and we started laughing, saying, here we are again. Why were you? But well, that's the kind of fun we had. And that's kind of.
Penny and I both, we worked with Lauren Bacall, the star, and we had the glamour of all of that, but then we knew Betty Persky.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So right. That's a good way to put it, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what made our friendship last for such a long time. And she didn't suffer fools gladly. You had to be always honest with her, as brutal as sometimes it could be, and vice versa, by the way. That's the way that you would have to maintain a friendship. You had to always be honest.
One of my favorite stories is when I left the business and got married to a doctor and was living in Atlanta and had this adorable little baby girl. And Betty was touring with her book, By Myself, mm-hmm. it was called. Mm-hmm. She was in Atlanta, and I got in touch. She said, come over to the hotel. So I come over with the baby, and she's on the floor playing with the baby from the second we walked in the door. Mm-hmm. She's crawling all over the floor playing with Heather. It was so cute. But
indeed.
That's who she is. I mean, that's who she is. She was a real, real person.
And also, career-wise and life-wise, she was a survivor. Nothing,
I'll say.
She was very strong that way, that, you know, when Bogey died, and she was, you know, not being offered roles and things, and she had two children to rear, and there wasn't a lot of money left because his estate wasn't that much, and a lot of it was put in trust. She had to work. And she wasn't working in Hollywood, and she just said, well, I'm going back to New York, and she worked in New York and got that wonderful apartment at the Dakota, which she always said was the only smart investment she ever made, and she lived very well and continued her life, and then, of course, had another marriage, which, you know, didn't work out, but she, as a result, had a son that she adores, and she adores all of her children, by the way. And so from that standpoint, she had a very fulfilling life, and she never sat and felt sorry for herself. She was always up and at 'em and doing what she did, and in the latter times, because of, you know, her hip and her leg and all of that, and just getting old, she still, you know, participated as much as she could. And she, you know, was quite wonderful always to have that bravado about herself.
And the roster of people that she knew, I mean, not just in show business, but the royalty of show business, like the Lunson and Noel Coward, all of whose autographs Leroy got in her dressing room. But, I mean, you know, the political people and the Bernstein, and she was related, supposedly, to Shimon Peres.
Yeah, she was first cousin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and she was with the very high top of our society and our world, and I think the reason that she survived all of that is, number one, her honesty, but also she had a great sense of humor. And that was the thing. And then, I mean, she could barb with the best of them. And
yep.
It was her humor that was really quite wonderful. And I know many, many times I was witness to all of that.
All right. Now, we've heard that as time went on, Miss Bacall and Mr. Carew got along splendidly.
Yes. And then it's in her book, and also Lynn it talks about it openly, that, you know, they did have an out-of-town affair.
So it was very nice of Mrs. Carew to celebrate the other night at Joe Allen's.
Well, that was long before she was in the
picture. Sure, I know, but some people get very... My point, the real question is, honestly, the real question is, once that started happening, did their scenes together and songs like One of a Kind even take on a greater resonance?
Yes, it did.
Mm-hmm. You felt it?
Yes. And there was an attraction, I think, from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And it was evident to me.
Well, why wouldn't there be? They're
yeah.
both such attractive people and to play that part.
And Betty was, you know, only 45, I think, when she started.
Right.
And she became 46. And so, you know, she was still a viable, sexy lady.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was quite wonderful. And they were a good pair. They were a good pair. But Lynn had another life that he went back to, and that's the way it is. But they remained friends.
And Heather Carew knew her,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I mean, it was no secret or anything like that, or not even what would you say, Leroy? Not even really uncomfortable, because of the affair, but just because she was who she was, mm-hmm. you know.
And Betty was very welcoming to her,
yes,
and
exactly.
also included her. And it was a very nice thing. And I think that as a result, Heather always felt comfortable. But that was Betty. She, you know, was a very bright lady. And so, you know, she handled it very well.
I, as you alluded, I believe until she started to have health problems and mobility problems that she got out a lot. All over, you know, New York. And I remember some years ago I was at a performance at New York City Opera. I didn't remember what it was, but my friend who I was with reminded me. I think it was the Lizzie Borden Opera. Mm-hmm. And she was sitting like two rows in front of us with, I believe, Arthur Miller and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would make sense.
And then two nights later, we were at 46th Street and 8th Avenue, and she got out of a cab right in front of us. Maybe she was headed to Joe Allen's, but my friend said she's following us all over New York City.
And, I mean, she could stop them dead in their tracks.
Oh,
you know,
God.
For instance, when people would come up and say, oh, Miss Bacall, I hate to intrude, and she would look and say, then why do you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, she could stop you in your tracks, and I know... She came out to do a benefit for me that I was directing in California. She hosted it in San Francisco, and there was a little TV gal who was there answering, you know, interviewing her. And she said, here we are backstage with with Lauren Bacall. So tell me, Lauren, which of course she shot her a look on that one, and she said, my mother would never forgive me if I didn't ask you. What do you think Humphrey Bogart would think of all the success you've had? She said, I don't know, he's dead.
Wow.
And then the second question to her, she said, and tell me, Lauren, whose dress are you wearing? And she shot her a look, and she said, mine. And she said, you want to know who designed the dress? You should ask me who designed the dress, but you didn't. I mean, she could put you in your place very quickly.
I guess it really depended on the situation. The one time I actually spoke with her was, of all places, in Sag Harbor. Julie Andrews was doing a Christmas concert.
Yes.
And, you know, it was quite a small little church, I believe, if I recall. And a bunch of us were waiting to go in, and there she was right next to me. And I said, hello, Miss Bacall. And she said, hello, how are you? And she couldn't have been lovelier. So I guess it, you know, I mean, it's, you know, she doesn't like to be interrupted when she's eating or when she's with somebody else. But in the right situation, she, I guess she was just fine.
Yes. Well, she was very good friends of Tony Walton's.
Oh,
first
okay.
husband. So they were all very close friends.
Yeah.
And she knew everybody. I mean, and everybody knew her. And she was courted. I mean, she was a wonderful person, and she was a great beauty in her day. And she was a good citizen. She took her role as a citizen very seriously politically. And she was very friendly with the Kennedy family. And, well, Penny mentioned earlier about, I mean, this is a good story, that I always collect posters from my shows, but I only have the people sign them whose name is on the poster. And so when we were with Applause, of course, I had everybody but Betty Comden. So when we opened in New York, I told Bacall, I said, when Betty Comden comes, I get her to sign my poster. She said, well, leave it down here in the dressing room, because I knew Betty wouldn't be coming upstairs to see me. So after the matinee, I went downstairs and walked in the dressing room, and I said, so did she sign it? Bacall said, yes, she did. She signed it. She said, oh, by the way, this is Ingrid Bergman. She was in the dressing room. And so how do you do, Miss Bergman? And Betty said, why don't you have Ingrid sign your poster? And I'm thinking, she's not in the show, but what did you do? So Ingrid Bergman signed my poster. And Betty said, let's leave the poster here, and everybody that you meet will get to sign the poster. So I have incredible names on that poster, names over the names, and it's one of my treasures. So that's the kind of person Betty was. And when my mother was passing away, Betty was leaving the show and Ann Baxter was coming in. But Betty was always very nice to my mother when she came to New York, and drove her home in the limousine after the show. And when my mother was dying, every day Betty called me in the morning when she got up, and she called me when she got to the theater that same day. So I had two phone calls from her every day while I was away. Mm. And that's the kind of human being that she was.
Right. And this, when my mother died, it was after we were done with the show. And she wrote me the greatest letter. She said, don't let anybody kid you. This is the worst thing that will ever happen to you, because you won't be her little girl anymore.
Mm.
And it just... It was the right thing to say, because it was so true, you know, like buck up, or oh, I feel so bad, you know. It was so true, and I didn't realize then, because coming into the show later, I didn't know that much, that she had lost her mother about, what was it, a year before?
Yeah.
Applause. And so, and she had a very, like I did, very, very close relationship with her mother. And so that's why she could be that brutally honest. And it was just the right thing to say in it, because it, there was no sentimentality or guff about it, you know.
Well, those are wonderful stories, and it's also nice to know that she was friendly with Ingrid Bergman, who played her role in Cactus Flower.
Oh, that's right. Good point.
Right, that's right. I forgot that.
You know, I mean, sometimes, not that, sure. So I guess that proves that she's not petty, you know, in that sense. That was great.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we were very privileged to have had her in our lives, and she obviously has affected both of us so very much, and how lucky we are to have had that experience, and also that person to live up to, and see what she did, and use that as an example.
And then guess what? She left a lovely legacy that we have each other.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she did. And then also the fact that when everything is said and done, the press and what has happened since she has passed away, the attention that she has received, and the things that have been said about her, now she truly will be a legend. And I was very pleased about that, and seeing all those wonderful photographs of her during her life, what a beauty she was, and the stories that she's left behind. And we're all sharing that now, and the media, of course, has picked up on it. And I'm so glad that she got that attention, because she deserved it.
Yes. There was that photo, well, there were several photos, but that huge, beautiful photo in the print edition of the New York Times obit, it was a Warner Brothers credit. I think it was maybe To Have and Have Not. Absolutely beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah.
And thank
Can you imagine to be,
old.
What was she, 19? To be 19, come to Hollywood, have your first job be opposite Humphrey Bogart in the, how she survived it, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And you read that thing about how she had told us that the look came from the fact that she was shaking with fear so much that Howard Hawks says, put your head down, honey, and that'll keep your chin from shaking, and that's where the look came from.
And also to fall in love with a man, and as she always said, he was the father she never had, the lover she never had, and the brother that she never had. So she, all that was wrapped into that relationship, but then when that was taken away, she basically was always Bogart's wife. And suddenly then to have to face her life, but because she's so intelligent and she was well-read, she educated herself and took advantage of all the incredible people that she met, and she could hold her own with them. That was the thing. I think that's why everybody loved her so much.
And speaking of being a survivor, she even survived Frank Sinatra.
That's mm-hmm. right. That's mm-hmm. right.
In more ways than one.
Yes.
Well, she really picked him, didn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The guys. I mean, they were the guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for talking to us.
Well,
it's really been great.
Oh, it was fun. It was fun to. I mean, I'm just sitting here thinking about her, and it makes me focus on thinking about her. So I thank you for that opportunity again.
Well, it was interesting that she passed away in a rainy afternoon, and one of her favorite songs, which she used to request me to sing so many times, was Here's That Rainy Day.
Mm.
So last night I was at 54 Below doing a little nightclub thing, and I dedicated it to her. So it's bringing back all those wonderful memories, and we'll continue to do so. She has left us all a legacy, and as I said, how fortunate we are to have had her in our lives.
God love you both.
I say so, too. Yeah, thank you so much
okay.
for letting us have this tribute.
Yeah,
right.
God bless you, Penny. We love
Thank you so right. much.
Thank yep. you, Leroy and Penny. We will talk with you soon.
Yeah, but thank
Bye.
You.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I don't know what to say. I mean, you might have noticed I went silent during the second half of that thing because I was just sitting here in awe listening to these stories. I mean, it's so wonderful to have captured some of these wonderful stories on a recording so that we can refer to them back in the future. I'm so excited to have Leroy and Penny with us. So let's move forward into the reviews. Peter got a chance to see a Texas trilogy over at the West Park Theater. So Peter wanted to tell us about that.
Well, it wasn't a chance. It was three chances because you have to see all three plays, and I really think everybody should. These plays were originally written in the mid-70s. They premiered at the Dallas Theater Center. This is still the early days of the regional theater movement trying to get new plays. And up until that point, you know, certainly well into the 60s, it was Arsenic and Old Lace and You Can't Take It With You. And wonderful plays though they are, the regional theater relied on War Horses and Chestnuts. But now they were starting to commission plays and ask people to write. And Preston Jones, who was running a workshop there, was asked to write. And boy, did he ever. He came up with three plays that were so sensational in Dallas that the famous agent Audrey Wood had to come down and see what was going on, sign them up, and suddenly they were wending their way to Broadway after the Kennedy Center, where they got great reviews too. However, the reviews were not so good in Broadway, and running three plays in rep is always a problem. It's a problem now, even, because the point is a lot of people say, well, if I can't see all three, I'm not going to see any of them. Frankly, each of the plays stands on its own, so you don't have to see all three, but you do get a little extra thrill if you do see all three, because certain things that happen in play one that you wouldn't necessarily think is important in play three turn out to be important because you've seen play one, that type of thing. All right. This is happening through the Regroup Theater, Ali Mulholland's group. Usually he takes plays in the 30s that were done by the Group Theater, hence the title of his company, Regroup. But he was so intoxicated by the Texas Trilogy that he just felt he had to do it, even though this would be a mammoth, mammoth task. There are about 24 people that he would have to direct in the three plays. Not everybody appears in the three plays. In fact, very few people do. But just arranging that must have been such a logistical nightmare, and yet he made it happen. Also, finding the right space wouldn't be easy either. And what he did was find this room in a hall in a church. And this is a good place, especially for one of the plays, The Last Meeting of the Knights of the White Magnolias, because this is a group of people who meet ostensibly to do good. But what good to them is keeping the black people in town under control. So this is a play that takes place in 1962, and things are changing, but they're not acknowledging that. And what really they do, more than anything else, is play dominoes, drink, and get into fights. What's really interesting is in the next play, called Lou Hampton Laverty Oberlander, one of the women in the play says, you know, I hear all that goes on down there is you people play dominoes, drink, and get into fights. And the person we've seen in the first play who did exactly that said, no, no, you don't know. You know, you're not there. So that's one of the things that makes seeing all three plays significant, because you know who's telling the truth and who isn't, because if you've seen the first play already. I have never seen an American writer deal with subtext so brilliantly as Preston Jones. I truly believe that no other writer I have ever encountered can put so much subtext into each and virtually every line. I mean, exposition lines have tremendous subtext. So these plays are really magnificent. And I really feel it's mandatory theater going. Yes, there's no question that this is not an ornate theater. Yes, there's no question you're going to be sitting on folding chairs. Yes, you're going to be sitting at tables, nice tables with red and white checkered tablecloths where you can certainly go to the bar and get drinks or a little bit of food. I mean, nothing really fancy, but you do sit there. And I will admit the acoustics are not first rate. And I will admit that they don't have much lighting. So sometimes people are in shadows. But my, are the productions good. The acting is superb. In the last meeting of the Knights of the White Magnolia, we meet Skip Hampton, played by Daniel Kristen. And I'm telling you, he seems to be just this guy who just will do anything to get a drink, and that's why he's there. But in the second play, Lou Ann Hampton, Laverty Oberlander, that's his sister. She's Lou Ann Hampton when the play starts. He's a guy who just feels he has the world by the tail. He's going to conquer this town of Bradleyville. He acts as if eventually they'll change the name of the town to Hampton because he's going to just take over everything. He's just going to be. And by the time this play ends, you see what he's become. And as magnificent as Daniel Kristen is in playing a good old boy at the beginning, when he has to play someone who is ravaged by time and is dependent on his sister, who starts out being a tough cookie and turns out to be quite a lovely marshmallow of a person. Luann, by the way, played by Rosalie Redman, tremendous, wonderful work, no question. Yeah, to see them together, you know, because so many times when people are young, brothers and sisters fight. And then as time goes on, they don't. They learn how to get along and they come to love each other. And the love that Luann has for her brother, you would have never predicted at the beginning of the play. But by the end of the play, she certainly has it. Time takes its toll on a lot of characters here. And in the third play, we come across the oldest living graduate. And that's Colonel Kincaid, J.C. Kincaid, fabulously played by John Lennartz, L-E-N-A-R-T-Z. Phenomenal performance of this crusty old guy who fought with Pershing in the Spanish-American War and World War I, and he knows everything, and don't tell me. And the poor soul is going senile and deaf, and it's one of those things where you give him a name, and he says never heard of him, and then 2 minutes later he's using the person's name, that type of thing. It could easily turn into character. It doesn't here, because this actor is so good in doing what he does. In the third play, he's living with his son. And it's very cherry orchardy, this play, because indeed, the son wants his father, the colonel, to give him a piece of land so that he and his partner can develop it. One of the interesting things is, though, that we get the impression this would not be a very good partnership between these two men who don't like each other and whose wives have issues with each other, too. But that's for the future. At the moment, he's trying to get the land from his father, and the father does not want to give it to him for sentimental reasons. I mean that, sentimental reasons. And if you go see the play, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. So the one thing I don't understand about two of the plays are the titles, because I don't think the first play should be called The Last Meeting of the Knights of the White Magnolia. I think it should simply be called The Knights of the White Magnolia, because that tells you right from the very start that this is the last meeting. It would be far more effective if indeed you didn't know that from the outset. But the title tells you that because these guys are not getting along anymore, and they're not accomplishing anything, and they know that their reason for being is dying out. The second play, we meet Lou Anne Hampton, and when she meets Dale Laverty, well, we know what's going to happen, don't we? And after that turns out to be a problem, when she meets Mr. Oberlander, well, we know what's going to happen, don't we? What's really wonderful about the play is that when she meets Dale Laverty, he starts talking about the fact that he just got a job driving a truck, and he just loved this truck, and he goes on and on talking about this truck. And then he talks about the fact that what he would really ideally love to live in is a trailer, because when you live in a trailer, you can be footloose and fancy free. When you feel like getting up and moving to another town, you can do that. You know, it's just so simple. And she's listening, and she's so impressed by him. And later we hear her talk about the reason she divorced him is because all he did was talk about trucks. That was it. And he just wanted to live in a trailer. It was well, the thing was, he didn't say to her, I'm going to be the mayor of this town and you're going to have a mink coat. He told her exactly what he was and what he wanted, and she went along with it. It was her fault, you know, for not thinking, well, maybe this isn't the life for me. What's so impressive is that she judges people by names, and that is a very important component of the play. I'm not going to say any more than that. Very, 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 very well directed. They've done so much good work in trying to turn this hall into something special. There's a working kitchen that turns out to be very significant for the scenes that take place there. I would urge you to sit in the front row if you can, but I'm hoping you're going to have trouble getting seats sitting in the front row, because I would like these plays to succeed wildly and this production to succeed wildly, because very few people would take on a job like this, but Ali Mulholland did, and he rose to the occasion beautifully. If you go this Saturday, the 23rd, you can see all three plays in one day, but otherwise you can see them over various days. There's a schedule, of course, and they're running till the 30th, and I'm hoping they're going to have to extend, because I will say the people walking out of that theater were so impressed with what they saw. And I have a feeling anybody who's listening who can get to them will be equally impressed, even on folding chairs, even in a place with not so hot lighting or acoustics. The play's the thing, but the production is too.
Wow, that's quite an endorsement. And you can see all three plays, as Peter mentioned, on the on this Saturday. It's 2, 5, and 8, is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's really... check it out if you can.
Peter, I'm not sure I understood. Do you mean in terms of the sight lines? Is that why you're specifically urging people to sit in the front row?
No, more for the acoustics. There's an echo factor more than anything else. And these words are so wonderful. You really want to hear them all. So I think sitting close is really a good thing. However, if indeed I were faced with the prospect of sitting in the last row or not going at all, I would definitely see them anyway. Because really, when do you get a chance to see these plays? And it's so sad when a play, and in this case plays, open in New York after having this tremendous reception out of town. The critics say, well, they weren't so hot. You know, and sometimes those expectations really are just too high. And I think that's what happened with these three, along with the fact that I say it's very hard for people to schedule three nights of their lives. Ironically enough, the prices aren't that far away now from what they were then. I'll grant you, you're not going to be sitting in a Broadway house, but nevertheless, $18 for each ticket, which today is a pretty good deal.
So I'm looking at their website here, and it brings me back to the Regroup Theater. So we've talked about Regroup a number of times before. They had that show, I think it was 1931 Dash,
yes,
that that we talked about. And we also talked about the House of Connolly,
sure,
and a few other things. So they're doing great work.
Yes, they are.
Great, great work. All right, so let's move forward. Michael got a chance to see Poor Behavior. So, Michael, tell us, what did you think about Poor Behavior?
Well, I thought it had a lot of good things in it, but I really did not like it overall, and I don't quite understand what the point of it was, if anything. I guess maybe it's supposed to be primarily a character sketch. This is a new play by Teresa Rebeck, and the basic situation is it's a country home, a second home somewhere. Unless I miss it, they don't actually specify. It could be the Hamptons, could be Columbia County, maybe Connecticut, somewhere not terribly far from New York City. And this home is owned by Peter, played by Jeff Beal, and Ella, played by Katie Chrysler. And they have their guests for the weekend or a few days or whatever. Another couple, Ian and Maureen. Ian is played by Brian Avers, and Maureen is played by Hardy Armbruster. And the play opens with this very vocal, intellectual argument between Ian and Ella. So those are two halves of two different couples about it's basically about the nature of good. What does good mean, G-O-O-D, in this world, in terms of people's actions and behavior? And it was interesting, but really kind of, unpleasant in a way, because they were so they get so intellectually angry with each other. And Ian in particular, I would say, is comes across as quite an unpleasant fellow, and just his being so so sure of himself and everything he says, all these pronouncements he's making. From the beginning I was a little confused, because doesn't Poor Behavior sound to you like it's going to be the title of an out and out comedy?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Sure, a British one, in fact. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would say that no, this is not an out and out comedy. And the whole first scene, I would say, is really not very funny at all. Later on, it starts to get quite amusing, but then it gets very dark. And basically, without giving away too much, the question that arises is whether or not Ian and Ella, the two who we see arguing at the beginning, may or may not be having an affair with each other. So that's the basic situation, but it just, I don't know, there's a lot of unpleasantness and inconsistent characterizations to me. There were some very odd things that I wasn't quite sure. Ian is apparently, he's supposed to be Irish, from Ireland, with quite a thick accent, very well done by Brian Avers, I might say. And I just couldn't quite figure out why he was supposed to be Irish. Now, there's no reason for him not to be, but I was wondering if it was going to have some significance. And to me, it never really did, and just proved kind of a distraction more than anything. Because, Rebeck does attempt to make a justification for him being Irish. Ian makes generalizations about Americans and how they behave and things like that. And there's also a question about his citizenship. So, but I still, to me, it was more of a distraction than anything, to be honest. And there are some other things that are thrown in for, I guess, interest factor. Maureen, Ian's husband, is she seems to be quite highly strung, to say the least, very neurotic. One might almost say mentally ill or emotionally disturbed to some degree or another. And so that kind of keeps things interesting and keeps people guessing. But I'm not sure, really, as I say, I don't think it hung together very well, and I'm not sure what the point was. Excellent acting, as you might imagine, by all four people. Jeff Beal, especially, I would say, is Peter in the least showy of the four roles. Really, really an excellent job. But everyone was at the top of their game. Directed by Evan Cabinet, and this is interesting. Aside from everything else, because it's a Primary Stages production at the Duke on 42nd Street, and this is their first show there. After quite a few years in residence at 59 East 59th Street. I'm not sure exactly. I don't know the circumstances of their leaving that place. It may have just come down to feeling it was too remote from the theater district. I honestly don't know. But
that this is a permanent move?
The press release, as I recall, said that this season will be presented at the Duke on 42nd Street. So they weren't making any general, you know, overall pronouncements. We'll see. Oh, and another interesting thing was I have been in the Duke on 42nd Street for several shows, and every show I have seen, it has had a different configuration. But this was the first time that it had a proscenium stadium seating configuration. Mm. So that was interesting to me. Bronx Bombers was there. I think Lincoln Center did a couple of shows there before the Clairteau was finished. But as I say, and it has been three-quarter thrust. I think it has been in the round. I saw one show there that had the audience seated on opposite sides, two opposite sides, and not the other two. But this is the first one that was, as I say, proscenium with stadium seating. And actually, to be honest, the sightlines weren't that great because of the angle. You couldn't see the very lip of the stage because it was cut off by heads of the people in front of you. But, you know, but people weren't acting at the lip of the stage, so it didn't turn out to be a big deal. Very well produced. Excellent set by Lauren Helpern. Costumes, Jessica Papps. Lighting, Jason Lyons. And yeah, very well produced, but and certainly not a waste of time or anything like that. But I don't think it really added up to anything that I couldn't quite understand what the point was. And I'd be interested to hear Peter's reaction when he sees it later this month.
Good, I'll tell you then.
All right, so we will come back and revisit that in a few weeks after Peter sees it. Michael, you also got a chance to see a few Fringe shows. So what'd you think?
Oh, yes, I saw both of them not in the official capacity of reviewing, so I won't say much, but I would like to mention them both because I thought that while far from perfect, they both had really a lot going for them and showed a lot of talent in terms of the writing. And one was a musical called Coming, which is probably a somewhat unfortunate title. It was at Theater 80 on St. Mark's, and it was a musical about young man who's supposed to be really the second coming of Jesus Christ. Oh. I mean, they don't kind of hammer it home, but and they don't make a tremendously big deal about the religious aspect of it, but that is what he's supposed to be. And then there's another character who's supposed to be basically Satan, and that showed a lot of promise. It was a musical, and it I think it was overwritten more than anything, but really a lot of good stuff. And the other one was a play called Skin in the Game that a friend of mine who actually, the last time I ever acted was in a play of his, and his name is Tony Junta. And that had a very interesting premise about these three or four, well, I guess four ultimately, prep school boys who wound up on this remote island off the coast of, here we are again, Ireland, summoned there by an alumnus of the school that they are currently attending. And I won't say anything more than that. It was really quite intriguing, and I hope that it has a future life so that you get to see it somewhere else.
Well, I saw it too, and I had a couple of issues with it. Maybe we should talk about this for a second. I understand why you don't want to give away the fact that the gentleman in question, the alumnus, is offering these boys the chance to have a full scholarship to college.
Yes.
Okay. And what they must do to get it is they must go over, take this plane to Ireland, and they must be involved in a competition there. Well, the thing that I wondered about is I don't know how high school kids who are presumably are living at home can say to their parents, look, I'm going away for a couple of days. I'm going on a plane ride to Ireland, and I'm going to be in this competition. I mean, I don't think parents would go for this. Do you?
Well, there were honestly a few things in the play that didn't make sense to me, but then there were some things that made sense eventually. At first you were like, what is going on? But I think we're supposed to believe the reason that that was plausible is that it turns out that this alumnus person is extremely famous and that everyone at the school knows. I mean, he's supposed to be almost like a Donald Trump level of like wealth and fame.
And so the actor was very good at portraying that too, I thought. Did you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I guess that's what I would say, Peter, is that although, again, you don't know all this at the beginning, and that's why it was quite a little confusing.
I don't think my mother would have let me go, I'll tell you. You know, I mean, but the other thing, too, the playwright asked me what I thought, and I said, if I were you, I would really put this in a much more innocent time, because we get so many things, you know.
Oh, yeah.
If you answer this email, the funds will be released from Yemen, and you'll be able to get $5 million. There are so many scams on the internet, and I think we're all smart enough to know that there's no free money, and there's no free ride, and there's nothing like that. And so for these kids and their parents, too, by extension, to believe that indeed this is a legitimate thing. Yes, it does turn out to be legitimate. But nevertheless, you know, when you're reading this thing, this is the type of thing you press the delete button. And I think that's a problem here for this play. Those things, of course, if we're in a more innocent era, then the problem becomes that the parents are even that much more protective, I think, of letting kids go. So I think that's a conundrum of this play. In terms of, aside from the situation being problematic for me, I thought the dialogue, the characterizations were first rate. I thought they were really terrific and engrossing, and the mystery of it and the way that it unfolds and all that is very, very skillful. If he can get around those two problems, he definitely has a terrific play here.
Oh, well, that's great. I'm glad to hear you say that. But I honestly do think it's supposed to be that one way or another, they are all supposed to be confident that it is actually this alumnus person who is this very famous and tremendously rich alumnus person who is inviting them away. So I think that is supposed to be the reason why they let them go.
All right, Michael, do you think your mother would have let you go?
I guess if they knew for a fact that it was really that person who was asking me to come there to compete. I mean, but, you know, but then there are all sorts of other questions, because the nature of the competition is completely unknown until they get there. And quite, I mean, not exactly run of the mill. Let's put it that way. So yeah, your point is well taken, Peter. It'll be interesting to see. Also the last, I can't give this away, but the very last moments did not make sense to me. And so maybe you can, I can talk about that after we stop recording.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. So that pretty much wraps up our reviews for this week. Before we go, we have just a few little items that we should talk about that have happened. Of course, Very big news is the passing away of Robin Williams, which happened after we last recorded. Mm-hmm. He, you know, had an impact on Broadway, of course, doing Bengal Tiger. Previously, what did he do before that?
Waiting for Godot.
Godot, that's right. Mm-hmm. So,
which was not even, interestingly enough, was not mentioned in the New York Times review. Now, it was off Broadway, theoretically. It was at the New House, the Mitzi New House. Mm-hmm. But it had Steve Martin in it.
Directed by Mike Nichols.
It had Meff Murray Abraham. It had Robin Williams. Yes, and directed by Mike Nichols. So it was, I remember I did not see it. You could not get a ticket.
Indeed.
To that.
So what did you guys, so you did see the Godot?
No.
I saw Bengal Tiger. That was my one
Bengal
time.
In fact, I wasn't reviewing that. I remember very vividly, I said to myself, you know, I've got a lot of friends. What's going to happen is, by the end of this run, one of them's going to call me and say, look, I got a ticket for Godot. You want to come tonight? So I'm not even going to bother trying, you know? And it reminds me of the Charlie Brown cartoon where he says, today I'm not going to call on anybody. I'm going to wait for somebody to call on me. In the next panel, it's dark, the moon is out. He says, well, that was a day wasted. Well, anyway, that was a run wasted for me that I didn't make an effort. I didn't lift a finger and nobody called. So,
boy, it really was. It was a very sad week last week, wasn't it? Wasn't it within two or three days of each other?
Yeah.
Robin Williams and then Lauren Bacall.
Mm. But, you know, the thing was, we had heard for a long time that
Miss Bacall wasn't
well, you know, and yeah. 89 is a damn good age. It's beyond the life expectancy. The situation with Robin Williams, of course, was far more tragic.
Yes.
And
I suppose it's partly because of the kind of performer that he was, the kind of humor that he did. But someone else remarked, and I'm sure you'll probably both agree, I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like the response in social media and the media and the regular media in terms of the sense of loss over his passing, you know, really just extraordinary.
Well, the fact that it took us all by surprise too was part of that as well. You know, I mean,
we
had to get it out. I mean, because it was just so so shocking.
Interesting thing for me about it was that in all the stories that were told, they were all these little kind gestures of his life.
Yes.
You know, you're not hearing about the big, huge, splashy parties where he drove a Ferrari into a pool and this and that happened. And no, they were all like, you know, I saw him at a donut shop at 2 a.m. and he was very kind to me or something like that.
That's right. Yeah.
It was really a wonderful person and a wonderful life.
And someone else made the point, this was so interesting, that, you know, there are so many, for someone who was dealing with the challenges that he had, which we you know, some of which we knew beforehand and some of which we didn't. There was never apparently any word of any lateness or bad behavior on movie sets or in.
Yeah.
He just, that wasn't what he did. And when you hear these stories about other people and the way they behave to colleagues and fans and just, you know, for people facing far, far lesser challenges, to be honest,
sure.
You know, it sounds like he was really quite a wonderful, wonderful human being.
So, other things in the news is that, it seems as though that the producers are finding Neverland are just pushing forward.
Yep.
Regardless of,
Mixed reviews.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens with that when that happens.
They have an official booking. I had heard they did. Did you? They're definitely coming in.
Let me see. March 27th I have in my calendar.
Okay. All right.
And was that the one that said at a Niederlander theater?
Yeah, at a Niederlander theater. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, fairly hot off the presses is the news that there is a tentative agreement between the Metropolitan Opera.
Ah, good.
Metropolitan Opera.
Metropolitan, not New York City, yeah.
And they're not here anymore.
Yeah.
the Metropolitan Opera and the musicians and the AGMA were the last two unions to settle. So that is actually, frankly, unexpectedly good news from what I had been hearing. Mm-hmm. I'm very, very, very happy to hear that.
And so, Peter, as a longtime investor in Broadway shows,
really,
yeah. There's a new investment platform.
Oh, yeah.
For the folks investing on the town, that you can invest in smaller amounts with less paperwork and less knowing. You have to know somebody or to get in on the on the deal here.
This happened in the 1962 with a guy named Seymour Val, who did very much the same thing, a consortium where he would raise money, little amounts, and put it all in that you could feel you have a piece of the show. I never invested with him, but I remember his doing that. I think he was involved with Sweet Charity. That rings a bell. But he certainly did try to do that for a while, and I don't know why it stopped, but it certainly did.
Well, that's it. But, of course, a major difference being that now the net can be cast much wider because of the internet,
sure,
et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anything you guys want to add in before we head off to the sunset?
No, let's head off to the sunset.
All righty. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You can listen to us in many other ways. One of the ways is on a Stitcher app. Stitcher is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. And This Week on Broadway will automatically stream to you so you don't have to download and sync it. We are also played on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today. Please jump over to iTunes and leave us a good review, because iTunes reviews helps us raise in the rankings there at iTunes. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Good night.
Good night.
Dear, good night.
You'll love it so. Welcome to the dirty concrete hallways. Welcome to the friendly roaches, too. Welcome to the pinchers from the stagehands. It's the only quiet thing they do. Welcome to the Philadelphia critics. Welcome, Librium and Nebutol. Welcome to a life of laryngitis. Welcome to dark toilets in the hall. Welcome to the flop you thought would run for years. Welcome to the world of fears and cheers and tears. Welcome to the theater. With some luck, you'll be a pro. You'll work and slave and scratch and bite. You'll learn to kill with sheer delight. You'll only come alive at night when you're in a show. So